Captain Donald, could you describe for me what your first operational seaplane station at Dundee was like? Paint a verbal picture of it for me and tell me what the character of the operational duties there were.
The station itself was very well laid out. It had been specially built. In fact, it was building before the war, only just before the RNAS, and had been under the command of Major Gordon, who had been of the Royal Marines and was now Major and Squadron Commander in the RNAS. And he supervised the layout of the station, and it was a very fine station, a real permanent station with fine concrete slipways and permanent corrugated iron sheds for the seaplanes. Quite decent little mess and good quarters for the men. And as things went then, it was a very well laid out station. But unfortunately, when I got there, I think I'd been posted there because Major Gordon had asked for me. And by the time I got there, he had been posted out to the Dardanelles area, so I missed him. It was rather couldn't be helped. And the seaplanes they were equipped with weren't up to much. As a matter of fact, they weren't. With one exception, they were no better than the ones training machines we'd had at Calshot.
What seaplanes were there there?
We had two very decent big Avro seaplane biplanes, which were quite nice in the air, quite flyable. But the thing was to get them there. The rather deep, narrow floats dug rather deeply into the water. Unless you had a reasonably good little sea running and a bit of a breeze, you simply couldn't get them unstuck. You could go flat out for the whole length of the Tay estuary. It was just a few miles down below Dundee itself, the station, without ever taking off. If the water was calm, you could have taxied across to Denmark before you took off. But once they were in the air, they were a very pleasant old plane. The one exception that I remember well was, again, a very nice short, I've forgotten the number, it was in my logs, with a 100-horsepower Gnome engine. That was a 14-cylinder, that's a double 50. One clapped in front of the other, and she was a very pleasant machine to fly, and you could generally get her off. And the jobs we did with them were more extended submarine patrols off the Perth of Tay, and I think it was largely a matter of standing by, waiting until somebody reported a submarine or a submarine alarm. But
did this occur very frequently?
Well, fortunately, my luck changed that it didn't need to, because the Admiralty sent up for the use of the station some very fine land planes, which of course couldn't be used from the seaplane station itself. And some arrangement had been made between the Admiralty and the War Office that we would take over the vacant Army aerodrome at Montrose, which is a matter of about 20-odd miles up the coast from Dundee.
You mentioned that Dundee was what one might describe as a custom-built seaplane station. Could you describe how this affected the efficiency of actually launching the seaplanes and getting them back into the sheds again? What were the advantages?
Oh, the thing was very well laid out in that the sheds and the slipway were placed properly close to one another without having to push the seaplanes round corners in this way and the other way to get them onto the slipway. At Dundee, the big doors would open very quickly. You had your machine's crew, a I can't remember from memory just how many men went into the doors opened very quickly. And each seaplane sat on its big trolley. Of course, it was wheeled straight out the shed under the head of the slipway, and the slope of the slipway had now been worked out with the other earlier seaplane stations. It was just about right that she didn't run away and take charge. Got your engine running, warmed up. Crew trundled you on, still on the trolley, right down the slipway. As soon as you were in reasonable depth of water, still on the slipway, the seaplane floats off the trolley, you open up your engine, and away you go, on the surface of the water. So the launch was quite quick. It was not unlike getting a lifeboat away. And at Dundee it worked very well with some very good machine crews. But as I say, after you got taxiing on the surface of the water, it wasn't always such a happy event getting them off the water.
Could you describe the reverse procedure for me? After you'd landed, being taken back into the shed, what were the mechanics of that?
Just the same thing in reverse. You came taxiing in straight for the middle of the slipway, and the part of your crew who actually grab hold of the aircraft, they've got deep waders on, they would wade into the trolleys, let down the slip into the water, and you simply aim your float straight at the trolley, and you could pretty well very nearly get around by yourself, but the chaps in the waders, two or three each side, could get hold of your floats, or in some cases wingtips, and I think you get hold of the wingtips, and guide around to the trolley. And as soon as you were on the trolley, cable from the trolley is round a big power winch up on the level ground, and away you went up the slipway on the trolley. And then as soon as you were on the level, cast off the cable, and the plane's crew took charge, trundled you into the shed, swinging around neatly and going in tail first.
Were there any personalities or characters at Dundee Seaplane Station who stand out in your mind particularly?
Oh, he was only stationed there for a very short time, I think. And what he was doing flying seaplanes, I do not know, but he could fly anything. It was Christopher Draper, then a flight lieutenant, and who was, in my opinion, undoubtedly the world's finest pilot, and remained that for a good many years. And I'll bet there were quite a lot of other people shared in the same idea. A few years later on the Western Front, they used to call him the Mad Major. But that's by the way. But he was there for a short time. And as I say, what he was doing on seaplanes, I don't know, but he could do anything with any sort of plane.
Are there any incidents involving Christopher Draper that stand out in your mind?
I can remember one. I don't know if he'll thank me for mentioning it, because, amazingly enough, I believe he's still alive in spite of the fact that he's slightly older than I am. It seems impossible, but there he is. I've been told he's alive and kicking. His great specialty was he could take a plane through quite a relatively narrow opening, you know, like taking a bicycle through a narrow gateway or something of that sort, and it's not just so easy as it looks. And he used to fly quite regularly through the Tay Bridge, which is not like the Forth Bridge. The Tay Railway Bridge, it was built on stone pillars, quite reasonably wide apart. But he used to fly through that quite gaily. And one day he challenged me to follow him through. So I followed behind him, and just a comfortable distance behind. As he went through, it struck me that he had dash little clearance at his wingtips, very little clearance. It struck me that wasn't enough for me anyway. So I may as well admit it here and now. I functioned at the last moment, just pulled the old... I was in the old short biplane, just pulled her right up and went over the bridge and not through. So when we got back to the station, Christopher said, well, you managed it all right. I had to admit to him, I funked it. And he said, what, what? I said, no, I funked it. He said, why? Well, I said, what clearance did you have at your wingtips? Oh, he said, about a foot and a half, I should think, each wing. 3 feet overall. Well, I said, you know, from a rough guess, I think the old short seaplane's 5 or 6 feet wider in span than the Avro, which you're flying. We could go and measure it, but I think I'm right. If I hadn't funked it, you know, I'm afraid we'd have knocked the T-bridge. Well, I'd have knocked the T-bridge down, and you'd have got the blame.
You were explaining earlier to me about the Admiralty sending you some land planes to Dundee, which you thereafter operated at Montrose. I think this was at the end of May 1915. Could you explain a little more about that to me?
Yes. I think probably due to the... It probably became obvious to the Air Department, who was pretty alive. Murray Souter, the Air Department, was a live wire, that this question of, you know, submarine alarm or a Zeppelin alarm or whatever it may be, to get your seaplanes airborne, you get them into the water quite quickly, but to get them airborne in a hurry, as we had to do, should have been able to do, wasn't very efficient. It was very, very slow. So they allocated several very good, very pleasantly up-to-date land planes to Dundee Seaplane Station, which was absolutely what the doctor ordered, as far as I was concerned.
What kind were they, and how many?
They sent, first of all, one dear old Bristol balloon, a brand new and a beauty. Henry Farman pusher, 80 horse gnome, and a very delicate machine, very nice machine to fly. And three of the well known Sopwiths, they called them spinning jennies because they were a little bit apt to, more on the ground, they were a little bit tricky to handle on the ground, but they were very, very, very efficient planes and exceedingly good. They were sort of ancestor of the Sopwith 1.5 Strutter and those other rather better known planes that came later, but they were good. So that was a total of 5 land planes.
And you moved these planes to Montrose?
Well, we had to. The point is the seaplane station itself had no available ground for landing them. And at that time, the famous number 2 squadron of the RFC, for whom Montrose airfield had been custom-built, just exactly the same as the seaplane station at Dundee had been built for the RNAS, they, of course, moved immediately to France because they were the only airplane squadron, to my knowledge, that the army had then. Because number 1 squadron was balloons. And I did know some of the number 2 chaps. I'd known them earlier on. They moved to France at the outbreak of war. The aerodrome was vacant. There were one huge shed completely clear and vacant, and the other was full of the accumulated personal trunks and luggage of the officers and people of number 2 squadron, stuff they couldn't take to France with them on an expeditionary force.
So you literally took over the RSC station.
Well, it must have been arranged between the Admiralty and the War Office. I don't think we actually hijacked it. But the first thing I knew was I found myself sent up to Montrose and very pleased about it. Finding myself CO of a perfectly good aerodrome, 5 very good aircraft, at least 9 or perhaps 11 personnel, and the whole East Coast of Scotland to look after, and 1 flight sub-lieutenant in command. It was an arduous job.
How many other pilots were there?
None. I was the only one.
You were the only one with five airplanes to fly.
Yes, well, you mean, well, it was none of them. I didn't actually write any off. There was no harm in having a few spares, you know. It just happened that pilots were rather scarce at that time, and they were beginning to get delivery of planes, and it was very nice having the spare ones there. But it kept you busy, but it was a marvellous summer.
Could you tell me how you reacted to your first experience of command?
Well, it was just like Murray Souter said, a kind of naval tradition is a ruddy job. You've got to go and do it. So it worked very well. I think I was able to camouflage the fact from my devoted air crew that I was a bit younger than I looked, perhaps. But to a very good crowd. I think I had two chief petty officers.
Could you describe for me...
Two petty officers and bottom... the rest of mechanics, right?
Could you describe for me the actual way you carried out your operational work on your own with five airplanes? How did you do the rotation? How much flying time did you give yourself?
Well, it's just a matter of being permanently on call. If there was a Zeppelin scare or a submarine scare, you went off. On the other hand, you did routine patrol sometimes, mostly covering the area off the 1st of Tay and the 1st of the 4th, because the battle cruisers were using the 1st of the 4th, and there was an awful lot of merchant shipping coming into the 1st of Tay. So when you weren't being called out on an alarm, which wasn't very often really, then you patrolled sort of... And occasionally to the north. One day you might do as far north as Stonehaven way up towards that coast. And the other times you patrol the mouth of the Tay in the fourth, sometimes as far south as St. Abbs. And sometimes up, as far up as coming up about Granton or Edinburgh and then back to Montrose. The total love. By that time we had a little armament. We weren't just so relying on various light pistols. Your observer had a rifle equipped with explosive ammunition.